Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I am your host, Benjamin Richardson. Now, in the autumn of 1996, an unassuming software house from Derby, England, rustled up the leaves of the video game industry with the release of an astonishing new 3D action game. Originally landing on the Sega Saturn, Tomb Raider put players in the combat boots of British explorer cum archaeologist Lara Croft, invited them on a globetrodden adventure to ancient ruins and forgotten temples unlike ever seen before. Shortly after arriving on the PlayStation, the game exploded in popularity. Lara captured the general public's imagination in a way not seen by a video game character since Pac-Man, becoming a mainstream cultural icon in the process. Tomb Raider was a complete phenomenon. It turned publisher Eidos' fortunes around, transforming pre-tax losses of $2.6 million to an astonishing $14.5 million profit. Naturally, a slew of sequels, movies, and merchandise opportunities followed in a bid to milk Lara Mania for all it was worth. With me to discuss the impact of Tomb Raider is a man who looks like he's robbed a few graves in his time. It's What Culture Music's James Dowse. James,
hello.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Very good. Now, James, what are your specific memories of Tomb Raider? How did you first get into the series? Obviously, you're a little younger than I am, so you didn't play it when it first released.
Yeah. As a family, I've got two older brothers who had the game growing up on the PlayStation 1, which was Tomb Raider 1, and then just after I was born, I assume, they broke the game, and then we had the Tomb Raider 2 and 3 on the PC.
They physically broke it.
Yes, physically broke it. Yep. That's a long story. Anyway, so I grew up on playing the PC versions of Tomb Raider 2 and 3, and sadly I wasn't born to play Tomb Raider 1 until recently, which I played Tomb Raider 1.
So did you play these Tomb Raider games after playing other games on like better consoles, better hardware? Did you play other Tomb Raider games before them by any chance?
No. I would probably say it was one of the first games I've ever played, Tomb Raider 2 and 3.
So that's an interesting introduction to video games, and it sort of gives you an early appreciation of how far gaming had came immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy them? Obviously you did.
I loved them. Tomb Raider 2 is personally my favourite, but after playing Tomb Raider 1, I can understand why that is a lot of other people's favourites.
Right, and you played Tomb Raider 3 as well?
Yes. I don't care for that one, to be honest. I like the first level where you slide down the hill, but
a lot of people don't, and I think it's because on the PlayStation it dispenses with a save system that is in any way fair or fun whatsoever. You have to collect save points in what is already an extraordinarily tough game. I can imagine for a young child that would be unbearable to play.
Was that the same feature on PC? Was it still not?
No,
just the passport
on the PC
system?
They gave a lot of leeway and just basically save when you like. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Save when you like.
That's the one I know. I didn't know about that PlayStation one, but yeah, go on.
So the most interesting thing about Tomb Raider for me, and when you came into it, is the actual character of Lara Croft. So for me, when I first played Tomb Raider, now I was a Nintendo adherent, and I've got the N64 for the PlayStation. So I actually, it wasn't until 1997 that I got into the PlayStation. I finally sort of dipped into the other side, became a turncoat, as it were. And I got a PlayStation with a four-game pack. It was Gran Turismo, Crash Bandicoot, Tomb Raider, and Tomb Raider 2. So that's pretty good four games.
That's very good, yeah.
But this was 97, is Tomb Raider 2. It was only, I think, 18 months after Tomb Raider came out that developed it. And this was still the height of Lara Mania. Lara Croft was very much a mainstream icon, which is sort of interesting when you consider that she wasn't even originally going to be the protagonist in the game. I think the initial plan was to have a male and a female character in the game that the player could choose between. But Toby Gard realised, you know, if I do that, I'm doubling my work here. It's hard enough as it is. There's only six people working on it, so he just basically he picked his favourite, which was a South, I think she was a woman of South American ethnicity called Laura Cruz. And then over time, they gradually refined it in, you know, the upper crust British explorer, Lara Croft.
Yeah.
And then quickly they realised this is an asset in its own right, and she became the key selling point of the game. She was in a full page spread of the Financial Times' prospectus. She was in the Sunday Telegraph, of all things. And then when the game was launched, she was in LucasAid commercials. She was on the cover of Lads Mags. She was in The Face, like a British style magazine. And of course, this was at the time when 3D graphics was starting to... Now, it sounds ridiculous to say it now, but it was starting to approach a point where they were just realistic enough for people to take them seriously. It wasn't pixels. It wasn't, you know, low color. People saw this fully 3D rendered woman and thought, wow, she could be a supermodel.
Yeah.
And for that reason, inevitably, she became exploited in the same way. You know, as much as she was a feminist icon, and she was like effectively the sixth Spice Girl, she really captured that girl power zeitgeist. She was also in the Lads Mags. It was, I remember Computer and Video Games magazine published really like elaborate instructions on how you could get Lara Croft naked in the game, which everyone just thought, no, that's normal. Everyone went home and tried it and thought nothing of it. Obviously, it's ridiculous now. But when you were coming into it, that Lara Croft's perception arguably had changed in a different way. She was maybe just a, you know, just a, she was an icon of video gaming, but she was just another character and she didn't carry any of those associated traits. How did you see Lara Croft? Did you understand why she was cool? Did you consider that she was cool?
See,
was she...
Go on.
I was going to say, did she draw you into the games at all, that character?
I think... I'm going to say that I would have probably played the game around 2002, 2003. So at this point, I'm presuming there was more female protagonists in video games by that point. So personally, I just thought, oh, cool, I'm playing as a character. But I bet when it first came out, that was a milestone for having video game female protagonists.
I mean, it was in a sense. I mean, there had been other games, obviously, before that with female protagonists, but none
Metroid,
that were quite on the same scale.
Metroid, obviously, yeah.
The thing is that Lara Croft, she became synonymous with PlayStation, and PlayStation made games cool. So they brought them into the mainstream view, and then you had this character who was emblematic of it and was a woman. So obviously, except for Miss Pac-Man, I guess, you want to consider her in the same light.
Yeah.
She was the first female character to actually take off and make people step back and realize actually games aren't just gun-toting men.
Yeah.
Some of them are gun-toting women.
Yeah.
But for you, you didn't get any of that. You just saw her as another game's character.
I just played the game, carried on, which is quite good, actually, when you think about it.
Well, that sort of goes to suggest that she did normalize.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Female protagonist.
Yeah, it's quite impressive how it managed to do that for no one to bat an eyelid. Just
but when you were playing Tomb Raider 2 or Tomb Raider 1, did you like the character? Did she appeal to you in any way?
Well, she's quite good, isn't she? Really,
she
kills
very
the tigers.
Good,
she kills the people.
She kills everything. So you didn't have any association with Angelina Jolie or think you're like, oh, she's a movie character. That's mean.
When did the movie come out? Was that 2003? I think it was.
When was it as late as that? I'm not sure.
It might, right. Either way, I'd seen that film and I just... It's a film, isn't it, really? It's not special. I don't know why they did it.
Well, it's interesting because... Did you play any of the other Tomb Raiders on the PlayStation 2?
I had Legends and then, what was the one? Angel of Darkness.
Right, okay. So Angel of Darkness was a bit of a disaster. And I think that was the first game where they started to mix up the... Like, Lara Croft essentially became the brand itself.
Yeah.
And they actually took... I think they took the logo from the movie and used it in the game. So it was a bit of a street fight of a movie, the game style of thing.
Yeah.
Like, they were trying to sell the game on the basis of a movie that was based on the game. So I think they were trying to say to people, you can play as Angelina Jolie in this game, which you couldn't, obviously. But have you seen any of those movies?
I've seen the Angelina Jolie one. Isn't there only one, and then there was one recently...
Was one recently? I watched it on the back of a plane. No, not the back of a plane. The back of a seat on a plane.
Ah, yes.
Coming home from South Korea, it wasn't on the back of my seat. It was on the back of someone else's. And despite having no sound, I still felt like I was able to follow the movie quite closely. And I still thought it was very, very boring.
Yeah.
And I ended up watching Mrs. Doubtfire on about seven other adjacent seats instead. I was really, really struggling to sleep, and this did not aid me. But watching it, I didn't get any sense of, you know, but it just felt like a generic action movie with no relation to the sense of wonder that was present in the original games.
Mm-hmm. Whereas I bet the Angelina Jolie one was a bit closer to the video games in some way.
It had, well, I don't know, it had Chris Barry as the butler. Ace, like, you know, I had Arnold Rimmer as Angelina Jolie's butler.
Yeah.
I'm glad to say I haven't seen it, but I think that was maybe the turning point for Lara's character. I just remember that as the games went on, there was a sort of a backlash towards her and how she'd been just forced down people's throats. People were just tired of that character, and that's why I'm asking, in your time frame of playing it, how maybe it wasn't seen as cool anymore, and you didn't really want to get in. But luckily, you were introduced at a good point. You didn't have any of that associated. That stigma that came in later times.
I would probably say, because we owned them all, we pretty much owned every single Tomb Raider game, but the one we played the most was the original trilogy of, well, 2 and 3 on the PC. I don't have many vivid memories of the PS2 ones.
Well, you wouldn't, because I would say they become really sort of rote and by the books.
That's what I mean, they weren't, you know, really as
very generic.
Phenomenal. As there was.
Yeah, I think that applies to the Crystal Dynamics Tomb Raiders in general. I did you play Rise of Tomb Raider or the Tomb Raider reboot?
Tomb Raider, what year was it?
2013, I believe.
Yes,
yeah.
I played that one. Played a bit of Rise of the Tomb Raider. I haven't played any of Shadow, but I've got it. But ready to complete Rise, ready for Shadow. So.
Yeah, see, I thought they were very good games, but I thought they were more basically just, they felt like Uncharted clones.
It was.
Having any identity of their own.
Yeah, it was Uncharted that you could play on an Xbox.
Yeah, even though I can't really criticise what they actually... I thought the story in the first one was a little bit naff. And the combat became very tiresome towards the end, as it does in every game, as you just shooting reams and reams of enemies. But it had no personality. And one of the... Getting to the next thing, obviously, if you played the original Tomb Raiders first, this might be a bit of a redundant question. But one of the things that puts a lot of people off revisiting those old Tomb Raider games... are the controls and the way that Lara moves. Mm-hmm. Now, Mario 64 was often compared to Tomb Raider at the time. People said that Tomb Raider was essentially the PlayStation's Mario 64. And this was simply because they were both big, expansive 3D action games that were symbolic of their respective consoles and sold lots and lots of copies. But if you actually play the two games side by side, you'll notice that they don't share a lot in common at all in terms of the gameplay, whereas Mario 64 emphasised fluidity and versatility, and it wasn't rigid at all. Tomb Raider is all about strict precision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually because the game was developed on a grid system. It's the only reason it was possible. It actually, I think it was in development well before Mario 64, and it's only when they came up with this grid idea that decided this is viable, this is a workable concept. As a result, controlling Lara is like controlling a forklift truck, which is something we'll get onto in the inevitable Shenmue podcast. you sort of have to like maneuver a very precisely into position, and you have to take a step back. Every jump is at a set distance, and metrics are very, very precisely defined. You didn't have a problem with that, I'm guessing, because you played it when you played it.
Yeah. It was, because it's not WASD, is it? It's actually the up, down, left, right on the keyboard, isn't it, to play?
Well, it's like it's like tank controls as well.
Which I guess at the time, because you don't really need the mouse to look around the environments, because that was put to shift so you could look up and down. But I remember Alt was jump, space was shoot, and it was a weird concoction that you was doing with your hands to be able to play the game. But you still felt very much in control of her as you were playing.
When we talk about Mario 64, one of the interesting things is that we both agree that if you play it back now, Mario, as fluid as he is, if you try and turn around, sometimes you'll just wang off the edge.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know how to do a proper turning circle.
She did that barrel thing, yeah.
Yeah, her solution was to go, you know, arse over tit, onto her face, do a ridiculous roll so she could point in the direction. But the irony of that ludicrous solution is that you could guarantee, no matter what, that you definitely wouldn't fall off an edge. You had the you had the security going forward. Did you think that gave the game its own personality? Did you think it made it feel like its own thing?
It was 100% its own thing, and I think The best example of it would be being able to tiptoe to the edges of platforms. Would you be able to do that on Mario 64 tiptoe? Could you do that?
No, where Mario 64 worked is that because it was so excited about its analog controls is that you had to sort of hold the analog stick very gently to do it. There was no walk button.
Yes, but Tomb Raider, I noticed very much with that, you tiptoe to the edge, you calculate, it was kind of like a math sum, as you said, with a grid system, and then you calculated where you were going to jump, then you stick your arms out as much as you can, and then you grab onto the ledge.
And right, that's exactly how I feel. It was like unlocking, the controls themselves were part of the puzzle, rather than just, I've worked out doing it, and you just do it. I played at a time when There was no concept of universal controls between games. You would generally have to learn how to play a game. Every game had its own tactile vocabulary, and that was just, that was just one of the processes, and I liked that. And every game felt like it had its own fingerprints. If you could play that game, you could strip away Lara Croft, you could strip away the environments, and play that game, and it'd still feel like Tomb Raider, which is in fact what actually happened when they made Death Trap Dungeon, and I think it was another game as well. Basically, just the same game, except it had a sword-wielding hero, a very, very, very scanty outfit, which they eventually changed. But one of the great things about it, about the level design, was that you would be able to read it perfectly. One, you'd look at a gap and know, okay, this is a long jump, this is a short jump, and then you'd be able to apply the controls to it perfectly.
Yep.
That was part of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Now, did you think that was lost in the later games? I certainly did.
I mean, is it even... Tomb Raider, the original trilogy, compared to the most recent trilogy, can you even compare them that much, to be honest?
I don't think you can, though.
No. Didn't they plan with Shadow to be more puzzle-based? Which I guess harkens back to the originals. But I don't think... With the new trilogy, it wasn't the most puzzle-based game. It was kind of more of an action game, really, wasn't it?
I thought it was absolutely an action game. I thought it was very much chasing the Uncharted cinematic narrative approach. Did you? A lot of people say that the old Tomb Raiders are very unfair as well. Like there were a lot of sudden deaths, and I think that happened as the games went on. Did you experience that in the first two at all, or did you always find that because of its level of precision, you had complete control of what you were doing, and mistakes you were punished for your own mistakes?
See, there was one thing I noticed that when you was doing like a running jump and you press Alt, sometimes you would fall off the cliff, and sometimes you just wouldn't, and it was very hit and miss whether it would actually work or not. But
see, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because I think if you do the core design recommended run and jump, it works every time.
Mm.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
But you don't really... I guess that's the issue coming into that game. You're expecting it to be more responsive than it is, and that's really not what it's about, especially if you're going back from newer games to it. That probably is where people trip up.
Yeah. Another thing, going on a slight bit of a tangent, but with Mario, comparing Mario to Tomb Raider, Mario, you felt like a small person. You felt very small, and you felt very... it sounds round. Very odd. Very round. Whereas Lara was very tall and thin, so your movement was very particular. Whereas Mario, he just ran around in big circles. But because of how Lara was, it was very intricate movements all of the
time. That's really interesting. That really speaks to where both games separately create the weight in the character.
Yeah.
I was filled with Mario, but it's partially inferred by the power meter that you have and the fact that you can make mistakes and collect coins and to retrieve your energy. But he feels softer. And like he can absorb punishment, and that's also to do with the way he physically is comported. Whereas Lara, she does feel fragile, doesn't she? At any point that she's going to get damaged, even though she's got a big long health bar. You can get mauled by a tiger, but a big drop will kill her.
Yeah,
and it's frightening. I totally agree with you there.
Frightening when you hear the sound bite of her screaming as she falls. Like sometimes a fall is fine, but the second you hear her scream, that's when you're like, oh god.
It's interesting that there's just. Sometimes it's only 1 inch the difference between like a
falling to death
and being crumpling up into a horrible bones and flesh. Now, we talk about the way the level designs effectively a puzzle that you unwrap.
Yeah.
We're also amongst the first levels in games to really create these epic moments of wonder. Is there anything that really stood out for you? Did you like also about you generally had a lack of guidance and you had to learn a work your way around them yourself. You have to understand the environment, and you really like he's got the sense of isolation, a sense of exploration that I don't think was replicated in later games.
I 100% agree with that, because playing Tomb Raider 1, the wonder of seeing like the Sphinx when in the Egypt levels underground and stuff, and seeing all of these beautiful environments. But when you get to Tomb Raider 2 and 3, I don't think that there was as much tomb raiding in those games, and you just went down the streets of Venice, the canals of Venice, sorry, and you went to the Great Wall of China, and you didn't see the wonderment that was in Tomb Raider 1 of seeing the Sphinx and then going underground. I think that the first one encapsulated the game much more than any of the sequels.
Yeah, and in the fourth one, The Last Revelation, they actually made it entirely tomb-based because people had said, this has just become an action game, we want tombs.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Sphinx. For me, that was one of the big moments. Like, I was really into Egyptology as a youngster. And this was, if you play it now, it looks ridiculous because you've got fog underground because the draw distance is so poor. Like, it feels like, it's hard to explain, it's like the lights have been turned off even in a cabin.
Yeah.
But seeing the Sphinx for me put me in the shoes of like Howard Carter with a pair of pistols. It was magnificent. And a lot of things that a lot of people point out was the T-Rex underground that just comes out of nowhere. It had a real... capacity for, for mixing the isolation that was so pensive and so immersive with these suddenly standout set pieces that put you on the edge of your seat. And it's really transportative quality that I don't think Mario 64 necessarily had, in the same way that was, like, it was a fantasy game. It was sort of, it was cartoonish. Mm-hmm. It was like Looney Tunes sort of stuff. But this felt real. It felt tangible.
Yeah. And there was a very big, wide variety of enemies in Tomb Raider 1. You got gorillas, tigers, T-Rexes, all these dinosaurs.
Pretty much every endangered species that you can think of.
Yeah, and she killed them all.
She was David Attenborough's nightmare.
But I don't think in the sequels there was that much killing of wild animals.
There was a lot of killing of mobsters and henchmen.
Yes, yes.
With baseball bats.
Yeah, and it got quite...
just walk around in circles.
Yeah, it got quite repetitive, defeating the same enemy over and over again in the sequels. But the first one had a lot of cool designs for enemies. Especially a bear at one point. That was cool.
It had bears, it had jaguars, it had... Yeah. I think at the end it had these sort of hideous...
Centaurs.
Flayed... It had the centaurs that fired lasers out their eyes. It had the flayed skeletons, I seem to remember, with the wings right at the end. Oh, and it had bosses. It did have human enemies. It had the cowboy.
Yep. Yes.
It had roller skate boy. Was one of the actual enemies. Yeah. Like a skateboarding kid. Skateboarding, I think, was his official name. A chap called Larson. He had a bit of personality. So yeah, they really drifted away from that.
Yeah.
Now we talk about the levels. I think one of the levels that most people remember, not really a level, was Croft Manor, which is essentially a training course. Did you bother with that? Did you get stuck in with that?
I loved Croft Manor in all of them, and I loved that every single game had a different variation of the house. That was very cool. The first one set the standard. I understand it did. It was very cool that you could go around her house, check out the boxes of her moving in. It's like they were waiting for a sequel to happen by saying, "We haven't moved in yet. We'll unlock these boxes soon."
Well, really. See, you mentioned that you've really sort of stumbled upon there that what made this so special is that you would know those boxes from her moving in. They were basically there just as an obstacle course. But it gave some context to the character. It was a training course that actually told you something about the story. I mean, Tomb Raider doesn't have the best story, but Lara's character is very well explored just through those little details. You learn a lot about her. You see, like, she's converted her manor into a tumbling course. She in a bedroom, she's got all her dad's artifacts. She's got a swimming pool. No, it's there to teach you things, but you learn as much about her as you do with controls. I think it's really interesting. And they really liked it as well. Obviously, Core expanded upon that in Tomb Raider 2. You have the assault course. You can lock a butler in the fridge, which everybody loves doing.
Yes, 100%.
But one of the interesting things about it, I think Toby Gard, or one of the programmers, he developed Lovecraft Manor in a weekend.
Really?
So I've just had this great idea, and then it became, again, one of the symbols of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the second one extended it so you could actually go outside of the manor, couldn't you? Because the first one you were stuck inside.
That's right, yeah.
The second one brought in the maze, which was haunting. Because
you could easily get stuck in there.
It was very easy to get mistaken where you're at. And then the third one brought in, didn't it bring in the quad bike?
Yeah, it had a quad bike.
Yeah, because it was a quad bike course in the maze as well, wasn't there?
Yep.
And it was probably the, as you say, the best level in the game, which was just half-assed in a weekend.
Unless you have the English heritage, seeing those manor grounds being chopped up by a massive, you know, ATV.
Yeah, it was just very, very good. And a very good idea, which is it replicated in the modern games?
Not so much, I don't think, no.
No.
I think it was in Tomb Raider Anniversary.
I should imagine so, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you say that they did those credits in the idea that they wanted to make a sequel. Ironically, they actually were so knackered after making Tomb Raider that they just wanted a rest. It'd been 2.5 years in development or whatever, but I just mentioned the profits I made earlier in the pod. They sort of said, look, you're getting on a second one immediately. So they were forced to make Tomb Raider 2 in record time.
Yeah.
And pretty quickly the game became, like, the first annualized game. Now, Tomb Raider 2 is... It's the first one you played.
Yes.
But you played it before Tomb Raider.
Yep.
Do you think it still holds up now, having played the first one?
Incredibly not, no. I always thought... Because about a year ago, me and you went on a Tomb Raider binge, didn't we, of playing...
We did, yeah.
Yeah.
We filled our boots, I think, for all 69 pence on Steam or something.
So we bought them all. But Tomb Raider 2, I think... Growing up, do you know when you just play a game and you only play like the first one or two levels, then you turn it off, game resets, first one or two levels over and over and over again. And the first two levels of Tomb Raider 2 where you go, it's Great Wall of China, and then it was the Venice. It was Venice.
Yes.
Both those two levels, stunning. And then recently, when we decided to carry on playing through them, I realized that after those two levels, it's not that good. The missions are here, there, and everywhere. There's occasional good highlights where there's the opera house. That was good. But then there's the Emerald City in the sky or whatever it was. I think that was
very difficult as well. There's a lot of guesswork. There's too much combat for me, and quite a lot of set pieces where you can where there's a lot of instant death.
Yeah. I just don't think it was as well designed as the first one. And in a way, you can kind of agree with this being rushed sentiment.
Yeah, I think also the focus went elsewhere. Like, it doesn't massively evolve the formula of that. You can now climb very, very slowly. And it has gimmicks like the speedboat and the snowmobile, and Lara's ponytail now waggles from side to side, which is something we actually tried to do in the first but couldn't do it, so it just gave her a little pop. So yeah, I actually think if you go back, you sort of see that it does feel tired in its design. Yeah. And then when you go to Tomb Raider 3, even more so, as it's just like one or two little features and maybe a slightly improved lighting system and you can pick your levels, but it doesn't actually... I think the problem it had is that other games were developing at a higher pace than Tomb Raider as well. It was getting very much stuck in the past.
Yeah. Tomb Raider 3, I might be wrong, but didn't they introduce the running meter as well?
You can now run, yes.
Yes.
Which a little bit faster.
Is that worth a new game? Just to be able to run?
No, not at all.
No.
And they kept that same engine right up until Angel of Darkness, by which point it was beyond old hat. It was ancient hat. It was the oldest hat.
Yeah.
It was a stovepipe hat by that point.
But it was still a revolutionary trilogy.
I think so. And even when, like, Angel of Darkness was a huge failure, to the extent that Eidos basically said, right, Court, this is too profitable for you, make a mess. We're taking this off you now, and they handed it to Crystal Dynamics. And Crystal Dynamics, even though they almost certainly wanted to go in their own direction, and they did with Tomb Raider Legend, they ended up developing Tomb Raider Anniversary, which was a remake of the first Tomb Raider. Even they recognised how important that game is, and obviously how profitable a remake would be. Did you play Tomb Raider Anniversary?
Yes.
Did you like it?
No.
I'm glad you said
that. It wasn't remotely close to being the same game. It had all the new mechanics, which
had lots of glitches where you died constantly because of them.
Yeah, and it just wasn't polished at all, and it kind of lost the magic of what was the originals.
Did you think it lost its individuality?
I mean, it then became somewhat more Uncharted 1 territory. That's when it started to become Uncharted.
Uncharted wasn't out yet, but it was.
Was it not?
No, it was on the PS2, so I think it was. It was pretty much standing away from the other third person action games of the era.
Right, okay.
You know, you just mentioned how your brothers, don't want to put blame on them, but they end up breaking Tomb Raider.
Yes.
I think Tomb Raider Anniversary was the first game whose disc I actually wanted to snap into. It annoyed me so much. I'm a very patient, calm man generally, but I despised it. You died constantly, and not for any fault of your own. I thought it didn't capture what made Tomb Raider special at all.
And that's a shame.
It is a shame.
They were in a bit of a dark place, really, wasn't they, after Angel of Darkness? They just didn't know, with all the history behind it, I don't think they knew what they were doing, really. And it wasn't until the 2013 reboot that they thought, let's start afresh.
But that was another attempt to try and capture the magic of Lara Croft, which I think it was a good game. It was very popular and it was quite successful, but I still don't feel like it did anything for the industry. I don't remember people thinking it was special in any way or that she was relevant again. And it's possible that Tomb Raider now is just, you know, it's a product of its time that's going to be almost impossible for anyone to get back into and really appreciate.
Yeah. And I feel like now it's just half the time it's just a benchmark test to see if your PC will run it, and then you turn it off afterwards.
Yep, it is that. So
that's it.
As we wrap up, just one final question.
Yeah.
We talk about the unfairness of the game, Lara's propensity to die. Of all the utterly brutal deaths that Lara was subjected to, and in a somewhat depraved question, was there any in particular that you enjoyed the most? What was most memorable?
In Venice, second level of Tomb Raider 2, and getting that speedboat, towards the end of the level, you've got to go through a minefield. To get through to the gates. Driving straight into that from the beginning of the missions, driving straight into the mines, blowing her up, and the boat, nothing beats it.
I personally like when you stand on Midas's hand and turn to solid gold.
Right.
Whereas she effectively becomes the most valuable artifact in the entire series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense since she's the game's key selling point. But the exploding Lara is up there. I think it's a cheat in Tomb Raider 2 to help you, to let you explode Lara.
Was there?
Yeah, I think you have to go through a complicated, like, acrobatic routine, and then she just blew up on the spot.
That's completely worth
really,
it.
Really, really, yeah, it spoke to cause. They were tired of her already. They killed her off in Tomb Raider 4, so they didn't have to make any more games.
Yeah.
So Vince said, no, you'll just do a prequel. That didn't work. But anyway, I think that probably wraps it up. Oh, it has to be anyway. Yeah. If you want to play the original Tomb Raider, there's a load of options. Obviously, mm-hmm. it's probably best on the PS1, or if you can get your hands on a Saturn. I think it's on PSN. It's on Steam.
It's on Steam.
And I think...
At one point in, I remember this very well, in 2013, they ported it to iOS. Why, I don't know, but you can't get them anymore. They've removed it from the App Store, and the controls were just as bad on that as well.
I would say it's probably a better way to play Tomb Raider on a phone than playing it on the N-Gage, Captain Picard's favourite handheld.
Did it come out on that?
It was a launch title for the N-Gage.
Oh, hell.
I mean, technically impressive, but it was still, what, a seven-year-old game at the time. Oh. You get to play it with 900 batteries on a phone. It wasn't the best. It should have made an actual game for it.
Yeah,
so.
Nah.
Oddly, it's never been on a Nintendo console. I don't think.
No. I think I might have actually owned Anniversary on the Wii.
Oh, so you could get a Nintendo console.
Yeah, I think Legends and Anniversary were the first Nintendo ones.
I know there was a Game Boy Color game, but I didn't know that. Oh, well, right. There's not been any since.
No, no, absolutely not.
And there probably won't be. But for now, that just about wraps things up. So if you have any questions or suggestions or whatever, send them to the hashtag WCGP. James, where can people follow you on socials if they so desire?
Wherever they want.
Wherever you want. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can't. But for now, that wraps up. Goodbye. Have a nice day.
See you later.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.